Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, like many of his colleagues, Congressman Adam Schiff came to politics from the law. He worked as a law clerk, then as an assistant United States attorney before running for office. Since 2001, he has served as a U.S. representative, Democrat, from Southern California. In his role as chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, he led the first impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Schiff's memoir of his experience of the Trump presidency is Midnight in Washington: How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. In no uncertain terms, Schiff blames his colleagues across the aisle, or nearly all of them, for enabling an immoral, anti-democratic president. He writes that the Republican Party has become, quote, an anti-truth, anti-democratic cult organized around the former president, unquote. About Schiff's work, Stacey Abrams writes, Midnight in Washington is a compelling account from a man who refused to allow our venerable institutions to crumble at the hands of authoritarianism. Equally vital, he refused to allow his Republican colleagues to look the other way. Representative Schiff does not merely provide riveting details from inside the halls of power. He delivers a much-needed warning about the threats facing America from within and an urgent how-to guide for preserving our nation. Congressman Adam Schiff is interviewed here by author and historian John Meacham. Meacham won a Pulitzer Prize for biography for his American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. The mutual admiration between Schiff and Meacham is evident. Schiff calls himself a Meacham fanboy, but the focus is on the dark significance of the Trump presidency, which culminated in the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and questions surrounding how we move forward as a nation. The Elliott Bay Book Company presented this conversation on October 21st. Elliott Bay's Rick Simonson introduced the program.
On behalf of my colleagues at the Elliott Bay Book Company, which is located on Duwamish land in the city of Seattle, we are honored to be presenting this program this evening with U.S. Congressman Adam Schiff for his extraordinary new book, Midnight in Washington, and for which the subtitle is as important, and not always, this is not always the case with books, but Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. He is joining us from Washington. This is his first book, and sometimes books by public figures such as Congressman Schiff are, you know, this sort of chronicle of their lives and the various things that have gotten them where they are. We hope he will write that book someday because he's a marvelous and tremendous writer, as this book reflects. But the book is very important and very timely, and very few people have been in a position to write such a book. Mr. Chairman Schiff will be in conversation tonight with someone else who's we're delighted to have with us, John Meacham, who is a distinguished author, and he's with us from Nashville, where he's Rogers Chair in the American Presidency at Vanderbilt University, and he's the author of, I believe, 9 books, author or editor, many of them presidential biographies, but his most recent book, which came out last year, is this beautiful, eloquent testimony to the late John Lewis, Representative John Lewis, this book, His Truth is Marching On, John Lewis and the Power of Hope. We again thank you all for joining us, and so ask you to all give good virtual attention and applause and gratitude to Congressman Adam Schiff and John Meacham. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you. I like to point out that I was called distinguished, Mr. Chairman, so just so you know that. So you can get to respect in your tone. I got to take what I can get here. We will not, I will pledge to you all, the congressman, all politics is local, as Speaker O'Neill taught us, and his district abuts Dodger Stadium. I will refrain from sharing how the Atlanta Braves from down the road are doing tonight. For those of you who are toggling between actual sport and this contest we're in for democracy itself. But an honor to be here with you. I had the pleasure of reading an early copy of this book. And as was just noted, I think with great delicacy, being sent a book by a politician is not the thing you wake up in the morning and really want to have happen to you for various reasons. But this was a great pleasure to read and an important book. And I'm delighted to see that it's receiving the hearing that it's clearly getting around the country. For those of you who may not have seen it, Jonathan Martin, my friend and longtime colleague, wrote, I think, a very very positive and very interesting review of the book today or yesterday in the New York Times, which I commend to you. Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to throw some batting practice your way. But I'm curious, did you know President Trump was going to be the threat that he emerged as he emerged? That is, in 2015, 2016, a lot of people saw him as a carnival barker, saw him as something of an aberration. You know, we can buckle our seatbelts and get through this. Did you share that more benign view, if I may? And then at what point did you begin to see him as a genuine threat to the constitutional order?
Well, John, first of all, thank you so much for moderating the discussion tonight. I'm such an enormous fan. It's going to be difficult for me to restrain myself from going all fanboy during the course of the evening, but I really so admire your work and I'm delighted to, I feel like I'm in your study tonight.
anytime.
You know, I used to tell a joke during the 2015 campaign when I was out on the stump and I was a surrogate for Hillary. I would say that there's no way that Donald Trump is going to become the Republican nominee. This was before the end of the primaries. And I said, for two reasons. The first is Republicans aren't that suicidal. And the second is Democrats aren't that lucky. Well, it turns out they were that suicidal. And we weren't that lucky. I never imagined that that Donald Trump could get elected because I did view him as this kind of clownish figure, this carnival barker, and essentially a grifter. And I didn't think the American people would go for that. In terms of when I realized that it was much worse than I expected, it was early in the first year of his presidency. So I think just a few months in, because he didn't seem to have any apparent ideology. I thought, you know, it was entirely possible that he was just being a showman during the campaign and not having a fixed ideology. He might tend to not be a partisan figure and maybe all over the map. But it soon became apparent that he either couldn't tell fact from fiction, or he was willing to be, you know, engaged in falsehood after falsehood after falsehood. And I remember early in the first year when in our committee we were charged with investigating what the Russians had done to interfere in our democracy and what they were doing, still reaching what now seems like a self-evident conclusion, but at the time was a kind of a startling one, which was that the threat to our democracy no longer came predominantly from outside the country. It came from within, as we saw him, you know, batter democratic norm after democratic norm. So I have to say, very early in the Trump administration, but not as early as many who knew that from well before his election.
Does that reflect the conversation, say, within the Democratic caucus, within the circles in which you moved? Was that a common evolution, do you think?
I think it was, with one very notable exception. My New York colleagues knew exactly who he was and what he represented. And indeed, you know, I couldn't fail but, you know, hear from every New Yorker, frankly, not just my colleagues, that any New Yorker would tell you, they would say to me, that the man is a complete con. And he's going to be an unmitigated disaster. And indeed he was. So New Yorkers understood him very well. The rest of the country did not. Of all the arguments that he made during that 2016 campaign, the one that concerned me the most was the one I think that resonated the most, which was the argument he made to the ones he called the forgotten people in flyover country, who had been, you know, toiling their whole life, had nothing set aside for retirement. They were going to have to work till they dropped. Their kids, if they were lucky enough to go to college, were in debt and had no jobs when they got out. He said that he was going to help their lot. Now he didn't, but nonetheless, these folks had had a Clinton as president, they had a Bush as president. Their life had not appreciably changed, and they were ready to vote for someone who was willing to break everything. And that was not an irrational choice. So I understood at one level how people voted in 2016. It was much harder for me 4 years later to understand, after seeing what he represented, why so many continued to vote for him.
So your title is intriguing. And democracies, as you know better than I do, as a architect of where we are now, someone in the arena, democracies often are far more reflective of who we are than formative of who we are. Politicians tend to be mirrors rather than makers, put another way. Give us your analysis, if you would, of how we've come so close to the midnight hour. You just alluded to it about so many folks over the last 30 or 40 years who have felt that the covenant of America, the notion that if you worked hard, you would be rewarded, tomorrow would be better than today, that fundamental began with Jefferson, that politics of optimism turned out not to be as durable as a lot of us would have hoped. But lay out, if you would, 2015, Trump steps into the race. I remember being, I think I'm right about this, the same day or two that he announced at Trump Tower, Jeb Bush was in New York doing the late night shows. It looked as though we were heading toward possibly as you alluded to, another Bush-Clinton race. As a kind of establishment Game of Thrones, if you will. What are the forces, both in the country, and then what's your analysis of Trump himself that pushed us to this dark hour?
Well, you're exactly right. I remember at that time thinking that that Bush represented by far, Jeb Bush represented by far the strongest candidate in the Republican primary. He was the one that I was rooting for to fail because he would be so formidable. So why was it that he ended up getting, I don't know, what was it, 1-3% of the vote? I think there were a couple really revolutionary forces operating began their churn decades previously, but really reached their culmination at this time. The first were these dramatic changes in the economy, akin to another industrial revolution, the globalization of the economy, the automation of the economy, the fact that millions of people at home and billions of people around the world were suddenly at risk of losing what they had. And I think often you see a truly kind of revolutionary forces, not among those who are most impoverished, but among those who suddenly have something to lose. And the fear of losing that can be extraordinarily potent. And because of these remarkable changes in the economy, suddenly people in the middle class were at risk of falling out. At the same time, we had a revolution in communication, which, unlike the printing press, we only had milliseconds to get used to. A medium in which lies travel far faster than truths, and fear and anger go viral. And you take these forces and you put them together, and I think they produce the kind of xenophobic populism that was already careening around the world, giving rise to Orban in Hungary and the far-right parties in Poland, in Germany, in Vienna, in France, We would see thereafter the rise of autocrats in places like the Philippines and Brazil. We would see Turkey's Erdogan increasingly autocratic, al-Sisi in Egypt. And so I think that this combination of immense economic anxiety and a new information environment in which fear can travel so quickly and find like-minded people produced, you know, a rare and hospitable environment for the kind of ugly nativism that is represented by Donald Trump. It's not, I think, a mystery why Brexit preceded Trump. It was the same forces, you know, the same forces actually, ironically, in Russia who were meddling in Brexit, but more importantly, the same global phenomena. Now, the other point that you make, I think, though, is exactly right also. And that is, okay, given that these were the global forces at play, once he was elected, why didn't our elected representatives defend their own institutions? And here I quote one of your colleagues, Robert Caro, who said in an interview that power doesn't corrupt as much as it reveals. And it doesn't always reveal us for our best, but it reveals a lot about who we are. And I would learn that a lot of the people I served with who I respected and admired because I believed that they believed what they were saying turned out not to believe it at all. Or if they did, none of it was quite so important as maintaining their own position or maybe getting a new position in a Trump administration.
Yeah. Put on your philosophical hat for a second, your wizard's cap, if you would, about democracy itself. Let me give you a statement to on the old phrase of the college exam, assess the validity of this statement. Democracy is one of the most counterintuitive undertakings in human experience. It depends on our seeing each other as neighbors and not as reflexive adversaries, and puts a premium on the capacity to sacrifice immediate interest for midterm and long-term gain. Is that, are you on board with that?
I am.
So are the forces, the factors you list, did they just be, so what I just said has been true since Athens, right? And we could sit here for hours and talk about various points in American history where these forces were unleashed, xenophobia being mostly a late 19th century and forward, but the Alien and Sedition Acts or the 1790s about controlling the press, about giving a president the power to deport foreigners by fiat. So these forces have been with us for a long time. People like me, and I won't pull anybody else into it. I believed that this was a difference of degree, not kind. I thought that Trump was a difference of degree, not kind. That he was the fullest manifestation of these darker impulses that we had managed to force into ebbing rather than flowing at various points in our history. And that the counterintuitive nature of democracy had managed to prevail at each point. I'm not so sure of that now, and I know you're not either. So give us kind of your democratic theory, and what do you see as possible sources of resilience?
Well, I agree with the premise that it's a counterintuitive idea. It's less counterintuitive for us than I think it was for the founders, who had every reason to be skeptical, but yet took that leap of faith. But I think that Donald Trump was a supremely talented arsonist. At a time when the world was filled with kindling. And it wasn't just the global situation with the economy. It wasn't just the information revolution. Also, you add to that a pandemic in which conspiracy theories tend to proliferate. But even through it all, I never lost hope. I don't lose hope now. And even in the midst of losing the trial in the Senate, I found myself optimistic. And I'll tell you why. You know, most people, I think, that watched the proceedings may have been under the impression that when the senators came back to the chamber to deliver their verdicts, it was a bit like a criminal trial when the judge calls the jury back in and you wait for a slip of paper to tell what the verdict's going to be. Actually, there were about 3 days that separated the end of closing arguments and the actual vote to convict or acquit. And in those 3 days, senators, often to an empty chamber, came onto the Senate floor and delivered their verdict and explained their thinking. And by the time Mitt Romney delivered his verdict in that form, all of the other senators who were at all in doubt had already made their intentions very clear. I didn't know what Mitt Romney was going to do. And I was in the House cloakroom, which is this little room off the House floor, alone and watching the television because I was told that Mitt Romney was going to speak soon. And when he approached his place in the Senate chamber, one of my staff stuck his head in the cloakroom door and said, "I'm hearing he's going to convict." And I didn't believe him. I mean, I'd heard so many things over the few years that preceded it to be just really skeptical of anything that seemed positive. And as Romney began his oration, which was very condemnatory of the president, I kept waiting for the inevitable but. And then it became clear it wasn't coming. And he was voting to convict, the first senator in history to vote to convict someone of his own party. And he got very emotional in talking about his faith and in talking about his children and his grandchildren. And listening to this, you know, very decent man acknowledge that he was going to incur a world of pain for what he was about to do, but he was going to do it anyway. And even if it meant he was just a footnote in history, that in the greatest country on earth, that should be enough for any citizen. It was such a beautiful and honest and heartfelt and courageous act of faith that I remember thinking, you know, the founders were right to believe that people possess sufficient virtue to be self-governing, that we didn't need to be ruled by a despot. And I believe that still. I have every confidence we're going to get through this. Sometimes when you're in the midst of crisis, it's hard to see how it ends or even if it ends, but this will end. And so I'm in the camp that you were in and may not still be in, of thinking this is an aberration. You know, like the period of McCarthy was an aberration and that we move forward. I find myself still optimistic. It'd be hard for me to get up in the morning if I wasn't.
Tell us about January 6th. Where were you? Walk us through that day.
About 6 months before the election, I had suggested to the speaker that we form a rump group of members to try to anticipate all that could go wrong on election day and the aftermath. And she thought it was a good idea. And about four of us came together to meet, you know, once a week or once a month to kind of brainstorm on what could happen. What if the Electoral College were tied? What if the vice president refused to accept a slate of electors? What if a state sent two electors? You know, when did the denominator change in terms of the counting? And we consulted with outside attorneys. We thought we anticipated everything, except, of course, what happened. We did not anticipate a bloody insurrection. But when the day finally came for that joint session, a lot of the questions that we had wrestled with had already been answered. There were still a few outstanding, like what would Mike Pence do? I was managing, along with those three colleagues, the debate on the floor, trying to respond to the efforts to decertify the election. And so I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on outside the chamber. And the first inkling I had that something was really wrong was I looked up from my notes and I saw that the speaker was gone. And I thought, that's odd, because I knew that she had intended to preside the entire time. And then almost immediately, two Capitol Police rushed onto the floor, grabbed our number two, Steny Hoyer, and whisked him off the floor. And I remember thinking to myself, I've never seen Steny move that fast. So soon there were increasingly severe warnings from the Capitol Police. There were rioters in the building. We needed to get out our gas masks. we may need to get down on the ground. And then finally, as the doors were being hammered and glass was shattering, we needed to get out. And I hung back in part because there was now a real logjam to get out the doors, and I didn't want to add to that scrum, in part because a lot of my Republican colleagues were not wearing masks, and it was early in the pandemic, and I didn't want to be, you know, shoulder to shoulder trying to get out. I also felt reasonably calm for whatever reason, and maybe it was disbelief of what was really happening. But I had a couple of Republicans come up to me and say, you need to get out. You can't let people see you. I know these people. I can talk to these people. You're in a completely different situation. And at first, I was, you know, very touched by their evident concern. But that feeling soon gave way to another, that if they hadn't been lying about the election, I wouldn't need to be worried about my security. None of us would need to be. I ended up walking out with a Republican member I didn't recognize, and I asked him how long he had been in Congress, and his answer really startled me. He said, 72 hours. And I said, what? And he said, I was just elected. And he was carrying this wooden post that had hand sanitizer attached to it. It was something that had been erected at the entrances to the House floor so that people could clean their hands. And he had ripped it out of the floor, and he was holding this post to use it as a club to defend himself. And I said, are you really that worried? And he said, I think I just heard gunshots. And I think that was when Ashley Babbitt was killed. And I didn't know what to say to him. And I looked at him and I said, jokingly, it's not always like this. Tragically, it is still a lot like that. Even after we saw to what end that lie brought us and that last president brought us, they're still pushing the same lie. The number two Republican in the House last Sunday was asked repeatedly, can you just say the election wasn't stolen? Couldn't bring himself to do it.
Yeah.
If we don't believe that elections can decide fairly who governs anymore, then it really does open it to political violence.
Mm-hmm. Does Mike Pence, in your view, fall in the Romney category, given what he did and what we now know about the pressure from the president?
No. For 4 years, he acquiesced in every immorality of the president. And so that he could position himself to run for that job one day. The fact that he did the bare minimum, which was nonetheless very important, but the bare minimum of not transgressing the Constitution and refusing to count the electors, I don't give him that much credit for merely doing the basic minimum of his job. And even now, he is out downplaying the significance of that insurrection. Even when they were trying to hang him, he is downplaying the significance of what took place. So, no, I don't. There are a lot of other heroic people, though. Dan Coats was the head of the intelligence community. He refused to change the facts to suit the president's preferred narrative about Russia or North Korea, knowing that it might cost him his job, and it did. Others too, Marie Yovanovitch, courageous ambassador to Ukraine, defied the president and testified, paving the way for others to show the same courage. And those examples are really what give me a lot of optimism about the future.
Talk about the speech that I think, I won't say it's going to define your public service, but it's certainly going to be a big part of it. It continues to be a kind of touchstone for people who share your concerns about the constitutional threat. But that closing argument, you were clearly aware of the moment, you discuss it in the book, but what did it feel like to basically tell the United States Senate that their very the DNA of their institution was at risk?
The Senate is a very small place. And I remember vividly the feeling of stepping into the Senate for the first time in many years. I had actually tried an impeachment case 10 years earlier against a federal judge. So it was, but nonetheless, it had been a long time. And I was struck immediately by how intimate it is. You can see every senator's face. You can see whether they're paying attention, whether they're moved, whether they're bored. And each day I would try to give a kind of a closing argument about what was notable that came out that day. And I think the one that you're referring to is one in which one of my staff approached me before I was going to make the final close of the day to tell me, grabbed my arm, and he told me, they think you've proven him guilty. They need to know why he should be removed. And it struck me, like a bolt of electricity, because I, you know, the senators were out, you know, during breaks telling the press that they believed the president's defense. And here I was being told reliably, because we had some very good intelligence that often came through Senator Schumer's staff about what they were hearing from Republicans. Here I was being told that what the Republicans have been telling the press was all wrong. They understood how guilty the president was. They just needed to be convinced why he should be removed, which meant by implication that they accepted the fact that the president of the United States withheld hundreds of millions of dollars from an ally at war in order to coerce that ally into helping him cheat in the election. And that wasn't enough. And I suddenly realized that what I needed to speak to wasn't, you know, his literal guilt on what he was charged with, but rather something bigger, why his continued presence in that office would pose a danger to the country. And I had been so moved during the House hearings when I had listened to Alexander Vindman discuss why he felt comfortable telling his father, this Ukrainian immigrant, why he shouldn't worry about his son standing up to the most powerful man in the world, because here right matters. And I remember being so struck with it because there was a certain innocence to Alexander Vindman, which I wasn't expecting from this, you know, decorated Purple Heart. But he said it like a prayer. And when I played that video in the Senate, I remember the reaction it got. And I remember, you know, Tim Kaine in particular had tears in his eyes. He was that moved just from seeing a tape of it. And I realized if those words had such power with me and with others, that was really the heart of what we were talking about. And so I made the argument to the Senate that Donald Trump was fundamentally indecent, fundamentally untruthful, that he couldn't tell right from wrong. And I didn't ask them to remove him because he was indecent, but because the senators were decent, because right mattered to them. Mm-hmm. And I concluded by saying, because if right doesn't matter, then we're lost. And indeed, you know, that has been my sort of conclusion from all of this, which is there's no problem in the drafting of the Constitution. There's no need to change the remedy of impeachment. We don't want to make it a majority vote and turn into a parliament. Mm-hmm. But it all presupposes that we live up to our oath, that we inform how we take that oath with ideas of right and wrong, that we apply the truth and principles of civility and decency. And if we don't, then none of it works. But that's how that argument came about. And my staff would always tell me that I did better when I didn't have something written out for me in advance. And that may be true, but it's really risky because, you never know if you're going to say the right thing or the really wrong thing.
Right, right. I find the hardest thing in public speaking is to try to do both. to have a text and then try to riff is just a, it's almost like the Odyssey. You get sucked into some mythological hell. But it was a brilliant performance, and I say that without acting as if it were theatrical, but it was in fact a lawyerly and principled creed de corps. And the corps was the heart of a constitutional democracy that is inherently fragile. And I think that, I suspect that part of the remarkable reaction to your book is people understanding that there was a dark and difficult passage, but not really being sure it's passed. And so I want to ask everybody to, if you have questions, shoot them to the Q&A queue so that I can make it as easy technologically as possible. And we'll get to those in a second. But talk to us about the next 3 years, the next 4 years. I personally don't think there's any doubt in the world that if he's able, that Donald Trump will run. I don't see why on earth he wouldn't. People say, oh, well, he doesn't want to lose. Well, if he loses, he'll say it's stolen. So what are you, that's not a dispositive argument to me. But if you would talk about Trump and that threat, but also what I think a lot of us think of as the franchise model. That is, are there potential successors to this movement? And it is a movement. It's taken over the Republican Party almost entirely. Do you worry about the next decade as well as the next half decade?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right, first of all, that he is going to run. Indeed, I think he's running already. I say that because I think that it would be intolerable to him to contemplate anyone else getting all that attention.
Yeah.
The idea that Mike Pence would be the nominee or Nikki Haley or DeSantis or any of these people would be excruciating for him to watch. And so I think pathologically, he's not capable of not running. So he's going to run. And I think given the grip he has on that party, he's going to be the nominee. And so for those in my party, I think we just need to take that as accepted and not underestimate him as we did in 2016. In terms of what if he did ride off into the sunset, or what if we're successful in defeating him? Does this go on? I'm optimistic there. There will be imitators, as you say, there already are. But, to give credit where credit is due, he's a uniquely talented grifter. And I don't think these other pretenders to the throne have his talent for grift. You got to take off your hat at a certain level and consider that here's a guy who campaigns for president on a platform of building a wall that Mexico is going to pay for. An absurd idea to begin with, absurd on its face. He becomes president. Of course, Mexico doesn't pay for a wall. A wall doesn't get built. Some of his cronies, including one who was recently held in criminal contempt, decide they're going to raise money from Trump supporters to build the wall. And they do, and then they steal it. And then Donald Trump pardons Bannon for stealing money from his own people. And he's still the undeniable nominee of that party. That's a really, really talented grifter. I'm not sure anyone could do it quite so well. So I am optimistic that when he passes from the political scene, it will be much harder to replicate whatever it is that has given him such a grip on people. But until that time comes, we're going to be dealing with all of his bile and all of his division and all of the new and inventive ways that he will get up in the morning determined to cause grief and consternation. I mean, the man couldn't even allow Colin Powell to rest at peace for a single day. And so, one of the things that I have to say, really gnaws at me, is that after that insurrection, after my Republican colleagues saw to what ends he had brought the country, there was a moment when they considered casting him aside. And I think for Kevin McCarthy, that moment of conscience, if that's what it was, lasted about 30 seconds. But you could really see Mitch McConnell wrestling with it. And I think when he decided 2 weeks after blaming Trump for the insurrection, that if he were nominated again, he would absolutely support him. I think when he made that decision, we lost the chance as a country to move forward. And now we're going to have to endure this trial for another few years until Trump is finally repudiated. And finally, I'll say that when more time passes, I don't think there's going to be any question about how history is going to judge this period. I think they will be damning of him. But I also think they will be damning of a lot of the people I serve with who enabled him and did so knowing what they were doing was tearing at the fabric of our democracy.
Yeah. As somebody who's just in the stands watching this, tell me if you think this is right. It seems to me on these points, Liz Cheney's primary is really important because otherwise there's no evidence electorally that standing up is incentivized.
I think you're right. I think that I would like to believe that Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger represent the future of the Republican Party when the party returns to being a party of conservative ideology and ideas. The question is that a near future or a distant future? And, you know, the near-term political challenges they face will tell us a lot about how long it will take for the Republican Party to become a party of ideas and not a cult around the former president. Our system really depends upon at least two functional parties. And right now, I think we only have one. Sadly, under Trump, the Republican Party has become an anti-democratic party and an anti-truth party. And so I really admire the courage that Liz Cheney is demonstrating and Adam Kinzinger. It is so telling in microcosm that Liz Cheney said she would not carry the big lie. And she was willing to give up her position if that's what it required. And Elise Stefanik said, well, I'm more than willing. And in that illustration, you got to see what Liz Cheney was made of, and you got to see what Elise Stefanik was made of, and it wasn't the same stuff.
Yep. Very good. Let me add a couple of questions from the folks, and then we'll see how the Dodgers are doing. What can the everyday person do every day and not just on voting day to fight for democracy?
Well, it's a great question. And I think the most debilitating thing for people is to feel powerless to affect their circumstances or what the country is going through. And the reality is that none of us are powerless. You know, we can't all be Marie Yovanovitch first through the breach. But I think we can all figure out in our own sphere, in our own circle, what we can do at a time when the democracy really depends on us. You know, John, I'm so admiring of you in so many ways, your brilliance, your craft, your writing, your knowledge of history. But I also admire that you were not willing to remain silent during this period. And it would have been very easy for you, indeed, most of your colleagues would rather not risk alienating any of their readers. No. You know, each of us, I think, in our private life have to make very similar decisions. They're not all as weighty as the one you made. You know, whether it's confronting things that we see wrong in our own workplace or our neighborhood, whether it's getting involved online to help some of these efforts, like what Stacey Abrams is doing, to fight back against efforts to disenfranchise people of color, lawyers who are donating their legal skills to protect the franchise. You know, what I suggest to people, because it's not the same for every person, don't try to do everything. Mm-hmm. Just try to figure out the one thing you can do. And it's empowering, just focusing on the one thing you can do. If I worried about all the things going wrong, instead of focusing on the things that I could try to do right, I would be paralyzed. And so I think there's a role for all of us right now.
No, I agree totally. And thank you for your kind words. I will say, in no way was what my actions commensurate with those genuine heroic people who fight all the time. I'm a boringly heterosexual white Southern male Episcopalian. Things work out for me in America. But I will say this. I don't know. I was born in 1969. So I don't know where I would have been on civil rights. I do know that if everybody of my age had actually been on the right side, hypothetically, then we wouldn't have had all the problems. So I don't know, but I do know now. And I do believe the Constitution's at risk. And I'm a big believer, and I think this has some hopefully resonance for all of us, because we're all incredibly fortunate, I know you believe this, to be in this country. And as we're taught, to whom much is given, much is expected. And so if not now, when is the question? I think this is, you and I have talked about this before, this is democracy's hour of maximum danger, certainly since Fort Sumter. And the Confederates didn't get into the Capitol during the Civil War, but they did on January 6th. And so in some ways, it's even more advanced. And I think it's tempting for people like me, who kind of weaponized being a dork, to want to say, well, you know, it was McCarthy, or it was the Second Klan, or, you know, the fever breaks. I know President Obama has said this. I know privately, I suspect publicly, that he thought the fever would break. Well, it hasn't broken yet.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's really remarkable. I was watching President Biden before we met tonight. And as he put it, in a 50-50 Senate, let me tell you, you've got 50 presidents. What's so interesting is he didn't have any occasion to say, you've got 60 or you've got 65. That is, that there aren't a dozen senators. You know, you have the scars to show for this. There aren't a dozen senators on the other side who have any even possibility of crossing the aisle. They did vote for the infrastructure bill. I think one of the great achievements of Biden's presidency so far, and nobody paid much attention to it, is he got 68 votes for a bill.
Yeah.
Which is like getting 120 in the old days. You know, it's just a remarkable thing. But I think what you just said is really important, which is to find the one thing. And maybe it's just feeding somebody who's hungry. And acts of character are also acts of citizenship in a democracy, because it is, in fact, the fullest expression of all of us. I'll stop preaching. One more question. Can I get an amen?
Amen. This is
related. Judy asked, how can we fix things so that the few, like Manchin, Sinema, McConnell, don't have so much power and influence?
Yeah. Well, you know, this may not be a very satisfying answer, but it gets to the point, John, you were making about Biden's comments about the 50-50 Senate. We can add a couple more Democratic senators and get rid of the filibuster. There was probably a time many years ago where I would have been more sympathetic to the filibuster rule. Most people got to know me over the last 4 years and have one impression of me as this ardent partisan. Prior to Trump, most of the criticism I got was for working too much across the aisle. And I don't consider myself a partisan. I do consider myself to be very much against Trump and Trumpism. But I think the reality is that in a majority that is essentially split down the middle, then one or two people who are willing to hold up the work of all the rest can succeed at doing it. And the only answer to that is to elect a couple more and do away with the archaic rule that prevents the majority from getting its work done. And you know, this raises a broader point that I also make in the book, which is so much of the way our government works right now is anti-majoritarian. In the House, when we have a gerrymander, a minority of Americans generally control the House. Mm-hmm. In the Senate, where 23% of the American people control 60% of the votes, it's a minority-based institution. You layer the filibuster on top of that, and it's minority rule on top of minority rule. With the Electoral College, the presidency is often occupied by someone who lost the popular vote by millions of people. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court is the least representative institution of them all now. And I think it's fair to ask, how long can a democracy survive? Certainly, how long could one thrive if a majority of the people don't control the direction of the country? And so I think the midterm plan, and here I'm not referring to the midterms, but the midterm plan, if we can't get H.R. 1 and the voting rights legislation passed now to eliminate the gerrymander and attack these voter suppression efforts, has to be getting rid of the gerrymander. I would like to see us admit the District of Columbia into the union. And as John can tell you all better than I can, there's a long tradition of admitting states for the purpose of changing the balance in the Senate, sure, including splitting the Dakotas. But in its own right, D.C. deserves to be a state. And Puerto Rico so chooses. And we need to finish that multi-state compact that would effectively do away with the Electoral College by states committing that whoever gets the popular vote nationally will earn all of the electoral votes from their state. Those are, I think, some of the most important midterm structural changes that we need to bring about.
So interesting. A final thought. Tell us what you hope people will come away from the book with.
I hope people get a sense both of how fragile the democracy is, how, you know, we grew up in the post-World War II era with the expectation that freedom was ever increasing and more people lived in societies with a free press and able to associate with whom they would or love whom they would. And we thought that this was somehow an immutable law of nature. Well, there's nothing immutable about it. I think the farther we get from the memories of fascism, the more we begin to question whether democracy is the right model. So it's a fragile thing. But I also want people to take away that we're going to get through this. And we're going to get through this because the number of people in America who love and honor and cherish our democracy vastly outnumber those who at this moment in history want to tear it down. So I'm betting on the future of America.
Great. Mr. Chairman, an honor to be with you. Thank you. The book is Midnight in Washington. Read, buy often. I love if you're already getting word of mouth, you're golden. It's perfect. Rick will tell you that's where you want to be, is people. Anyone in this media climate, someone in chairmanship's position can kind of get some astroturf attention. What really is interesting, I always call it the day four problem. That is, somebody might go out and get it because they saw you on something. It's the person who then looks at it, reads it, and says, hey, you got to read this. And that's the important balance. I think you're already there. So thank you. Rick, I'll hand it back over.
Thank you, John. And I'll just say that's exactly what I think what is happening. Both of you, this has been a totally energizing and riveting conversation. And thank you both for your part in it. And certainly, Mr. Congressman, thank you for the book, for the time you've given it tonight to us, and for the work you have done and are continuing to do. And I think it's helping instill the need to keep paying attention to where things are, where they're going, and again, what it takes to write a book and read it is part of all this too, to know the ground we're standing on.
And to say something really important, I'll just point out we're in the bottom of the fifth. I will share nothing else.
and is that the bottom of the fifth of the country or in the game tonight?
I leave that to the audience.
For those of you who weren't here at the beginning, there's a certain Los Angeles Dodger game being followed. I think that's it.
Correct.
Just so you know, those who weren't here at the beginning. Thank you again, and take care. Sure. Godspeed both, and good luck with everything.
The Elliott Bay Book Company presented this conversation on October 21st. To find the full event and other great Seattle area talks, go to our website, kuow.org/speakers. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast and share your comments. Thank you for listening. Tune in again soon.